start with the FOIP business to remind everyone that this session is being recorded so that we'll be able to have access to it after the event. And it's my great pleasure to introduce Lorna Stefanik from SOLV, who is presenting a talk entitled Waterton Glacier International. Transboundary Conservation, Citizen Security, and Cross-Border Collaboration. It just says Waterton Glacier on the slide. So I'm happily reading your slide.
You're confusing her over.
Anyway, Lorna took quite a while to get her degree. She was into skiing and delivering Her Majesty's Mail. And then she has taught at all of the universities in Alberta since then. And her graduate work in early publications focused on environmental policy and environmental interest groups. More recently, she's written papers on administrative accountability, access, privacy legislation, cyber communities, which we're attempting to have here right now, online learning, and local government. And without further ado, I think I'd better turn the mic over to Lorna and we can get going with today's talk.
Okay, a point of clarification here. The reason it took me so long to get a university degree is because I started at Athabasca University. It's the tradition of an AU student to do everything else but your studies, right? So, anyway, thank you very much for organizing this session, and thanks in particular, Kathy, for the nice email you sent me a couple weeks ago asking me. And a little edge on the in the note, so I assume you haven't forgotten about this presentation, right? to which I got to say, I think I handled that pretty good. If she could have seen me at the other end of the email, deer in headlights. I was going to present one of the two papers that I'm presenting at the Learners Conference in the end of May. There's one small problem, that is that I haven't actually started either paper yet. So I scrambled. Okay, I'll present a paper that I presented at a conference in January. And of course, the only small problem with that was that the actual talk was about 10 or 15 minutes, and I think the expectation here is I'm going to go on a little longer. So anyway, I very confidently emailed back. Well, of course I remember, like, duh. But anyway, this is my attempt. It's too bad Meenal's not here, because this is a paper that I presented at the Border Regions in Transition conference, an international conference focusing on borders. And what you say are my interests in borders and experience and history? Well, nothing, actually, to tell you the truth. Meenal, when she first arrived, was having a hard time figuring me out, and she said at one point, I don't get it. You're Canadian, and you don't present in international conferences in warm places in January. Like, what's wrong with you? So anyway, I thought, okay, you know what? With that in mind, when the call for papers came out, I thought, okay, I'm going there. It's Victoria in January. That works for me. But what could I possibly do around borders? Well, I came up with a bright idea to do something on the Waterton Glacier International Peace Park. And this, watch me with my, impress you with my prowess, pretty good, eh? First slide, and I managed to click, find the right button. I actually got quite excited about doing this paper because 10 years ago I taught at the University of Lethbridge, and I did quite a lot of work around the Castle Crown area, which is just on right beside the Waterton Glacier Park. And the Castle Crown at that time was a really, really hot environmental issue, and I did a lot of work around the land management and the environmental groups that were forming around that issue. So I thought, perfect, this gives me an opportunity to get back to what I was doing 10 years ago. So this paper examines the potential for international peace parks to promote peace between neighbors. And of course, specifically Waterton Glacier, which is the first international peace park. So, to begin at the beginning, In 2004, the Nobel Peace Prize was presented to a leading Kenyan environmental activist, somebody who was a leader in Africa's anti-corruption, democratic rights, and women's movements. And at the time, this really caused quite a kerfuffle because this had never been done before. It was a very, very controversial decision. And basically what it did was it reformulated the concept of peace by linking peace to peace with respect to economic, social, and cultural security to ecological viability. What a notion. But really, it's not a new concept. A case in point is Waterton Glacier, which that was established in 1932. Now, the notion of a peace park was something that was picked up by Nelson Mandela 50 years later when he co-founded the Peace Park Foundation. And the notion is, and quit smiling, Mark, I can hear the first question here, the removal of artificial boundaries, and to anticipate your question, as in you drop a boundary and call it, this is my country, that's your country, and I guess artificial in terms of the environment. But the notion is to remove the boundaries to allow the free migration of animals and humans, but also to encourage economic development, tourism, and goodwill. And the notion, of course, is that once you get countries working toward the common good as defined by this environment and with those ideas in mind, that maybe it'll decrease conflict. Now, from a conservation point of view, this is interesting because it scales up biodiversity in otherwise what would otherwise be fragmented ecosystems. And it reflects a shift of focus to the entire ecosystem. And before that, conservationists were really looking at sectoral conservation. So you're either protecting water, you're protecting air, or you're protecting a particular watershed. And this is looking at an entire ecosystem. So Peace Parks proponents claim that parks will result in large, contiguous ecological habitats that simultaneously protect biodiversity, create widespread opportunities for tourism, venture investment, alleviate poverty, reunite previously separated ethnic groups, and promote good political relations between neighboring states. Cool, eh? Would it be wonderful if it actually did that? And of course, my question as well. So it sounds great, but where's the meat? Where's the empirical evidence? So anyway, so the Waterton Glacier, of course, it represents this ecosystem approach to conservation, but also it's an approach for managing the northern border. But it stands in very sharp contrast to other American initiatives that seek to promote national security on the southern border, the southern frontier, by sealing borders and, as a result, dividing ecosystems, plural. So what my argument in the paper is that while the Waterton Glacier Park stood in the past as a symbol to the world of peaceful coexistence, its future utility as a conservation management model that promotes collaboration may diminish given the heightened concern for perimeter security after the 9/11 terrorist attacks on the U.S. See, and it's all her fault, you know, you missed out why you were the impetus for this entire paper. You know? You'll have to wait until the end. So, Meenal just walked in, as you can tell. Anyway, so as often happens in research papers, I roared off in this one direction, bright idea of what I was going to do. And then, of course, you end up meandering around and getting involved in all sorts of other issues. So we're going to take a little tour here. We're going to start in Waterton Glacier. But, in fact, what we're going to do is go down into the south and check out what's happening down there. And then eventually we're going to come back to Waterton Glacier. That is, if I can figure out how to move the slide. Hang on. I'm on a roll. Okay, so starting with Waterton Glacier. There's two men who are credited with coming up with the notion of a peace park, and that would be George Brown, who is the first superintendent of Waterton, and this... See, that's why you don't actually look at it, so Kathy can be here and deal with it. Anyway, George Brown was the first superintendent of Waterton, and just to give you a time frame, he was born in 1839, died in 1916, so this was before the First World War. And the second guy, Henry Death on the Trail Reynolds, was a forest ranger in Glacier, and he was stationed at the Camp Creek, which is close to the Goat Haunt Ranger Station. I have to read you these two quotes from these guys. These are real colorful guys. Death on the Trail, Reynolds has that name, and actually that is what he's called. It was very hard for me to figure out what his first name was, because that's what everybody called him, apparently, who's an incredibly fast hiker. And he used to hike down quite regularly to visit George Brown to pick up his mail and whatever. He was on the American side, but he'd come down into Waterton. And I think these two guys just completely epitomize an American and a Canadian approach to just about anything. You know, I tell first-year political science students, just look at our constitutions. Ours starts with this really inspiring, whereas the provinces of, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, want to get together and create a country, this is how we're going to do it. Whereas, of course, Americans are we the people, and it's followed by this incredibly inspiring whatever. This is what George Brown had to say about it, the Canadian guy. Quote, "It seems advisable to greatly enlarge this park. It might be well to have a preserve and breeding grounds in conjunction with the United States Glacier Park." Okay, so that's him now, Death on the Trail. And if you have a look at these the pictures here, down right at the end of the lake is pretty much how you get into Glacier. Waterton is it's the town site, and then you take a boat over to get to the American side where Death on the Trail was. And his quote is, quote, "The geology recognizes no boundaries, and as the lake lay, no man-made boundary could cleave the waters apart." So that's the American guy. But anyway, it wasn't actually for another dozen years after that this actually happened, this designation of these parks. And what happened was the Cardston Rotary Club came up with the bright idea to do this. So they hosted a Goodwill meeting. And waitress, I'd have one of those. Thank you. The Cardston hosted this meeting, thanks, Laura, in 1931 between the Montana and the Alberta Rotary Clubs, and they, the whole point of this meeting was to come together and to create these parks. And it's amazing, those of you who know how long it takes to create anything, they did it in a year, okay? And the reason for that, just think of the context here. 1931, we're after the Great War. Remember, the war to end all wars, and we're a little bit concerned about what's going on in Europe right now. The stock market crashes in 1929. There's a drought, and of course, these guys are living right in Cardston. You know, you're on the prairies there. We've got the onset of the Great Depression. So a lot of people looked at this as something optimistic and hopeful. There's something that we can get excited about. So this went through very quickly. It captured the imagination of everybody, both on the American and the Canadian side. In 1932, both the U.S. and Canada designated the parks as such, as peace parks. The later, in 76 and 79, the UN designated these as biosphere reserves, and later in 1995 they became World Heritage Sites. And this is a park is unique in the world. It's the only park that has all three designations. So just to give you, again, a sort of sense of the scale here, Waterton is 505 square kilometers, and Glacier is about 4,000. So we're talking a fairly big area. It comprises three major watersheds, and where these things meet, there's some very interesting flora and fauna because of these connections, and it's often referred to as the crown of the continent because you've got the spine of the Rocky Mountains that runs through this. So really quite an interesting place if you've never been there. Okay. Now, Another interesting thing that's happening, and this Waterton Glacier is actually sort of the epicenter of this, is a second initiative.
Really doesn't happen, does it? Hey, you're back. We need to go back a slide.
Okay, thanks. Anyway, the Castle Crown is the epicenter basically of another really incredible initiative. It's called the YTY Yellowstone to Yukon. And what this conservation initiative is, if you want to talk about erasing boundaries, it's sorry, Illuminate people, I'm going to the board.
It's an initiative that starts in Wyoming. No, Yellowstone Park, yes. And stretches all the way to the Yukon. So an
incredible landmass of 3,200 kilometers that they're proposing be conserved. And again, if you want to think about the bigger picture ecosystem approach to environmental conservation, this would be it. And for me personally, this is just fascinating because when I was in Lethbridge in 97, I guess, I went to their first conference. They hosted it in Waterton. And it was a really, really exciting conference. The concept was just introduced then. And so last, I guess it would have been, when did I present this paper in January? I guess it would have been October or November. I went down to Kenmore to check out what was going on with Yellowstone to Yukon. And I was absolutely shocked to realize that this little gem has, in 10 years, has grown to, it comprises now 300 environmental groups across the border. They've got a budget now of like $1.5 million. The office that I went to had like 14 people in it. It's a very, very interesting example of how subnational and even national conservation is now starting morphing into a national, international, the management level is moving up there. And I think it's also very interesting that this idea, the genesis of the idea happened right around the time of the widespread introduction of the internet. So I think there's a couple things happening here that groups are very easily mobilized. So the, like I said, just in terms of understanding international initiatives for conservation, this is a very good example. But so now that you're all pumped and it's also very positive, and man, do I ever feel great about all this, we'll talk about the maybe more. You know, I'm not sure. I don't. Dempster Highway you're talking about? Yeah. Yeah. You know, I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, okay. So we've got all this really interesting example of collaboration, cooperation, and how does that work? Well, we've got to juxtapose it, I guess, against the heightened concern in the U.S. In terms of its vulnerability to international terrorism. And there's a number of pieces of legislation that have been passed that are really going to have a huge impact on any efforts, certainly around Waterton Glacier, to manage environmental issues internationally. The first, of course, would be the USA Patriot Act. That was the first law that was passed to promote American safeness, I guess you'd call it. But the two that are of interest to this paper is the Real ID Act of 2005 and the Secure Fence Act of 2006. Now, the Real ID Act does a whole bunch of things, but again, for this paper, what it does is it provides for improving barriers at borders. And it gives the Secretary of Homeland Security the discretion to waive all laws, any laws that he determines are getting in his way to constructing or them for constructing roads and barriers. The Secretary's decision is final, It's not subject to judicial review, and it overrides the Endangered Species Act, the National Forest Management Act, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, the Coastal Zone Management Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the National Historic Preservation Act, and on it goes. It's really not that big a deal, right? So, and you can see this picture behind me here. This is just, you know, one example of it. It's a double or triple 15-foot concrete barrier that 854 miles of it. There's 300 miles of vertical, vehicle barriers and virtual walls that comprise integrated surveillance systems. Now, you can imagine, you don't have to be a brain surgeon to figure this one out, what the implications are going to be for wildlife. If you're on one side of the border there and you got a 15-foot concrete wall, it kind of has a bit of an impact in terms of migration patterns and all the rest of it. Now, this is very much, the context of these acts are very, very much framed as being aimed at international terrorism, but really, in fact, it's about drugs and aliens. Okay, call me naive, guys. Okay, I'm just a Canadian up here interested in plants and trees and animals or whatever. But of course, I ended up spending a lot of time on anti-immigration sites on the internet down in the States, and I tell you, it was. Whoa, what an eye-opener. This is an absolutely huge, huge issue down in the States. I absolutely love these pictures because I thought, I pulled this off of a site, an anti-immigration site, and you can see the top photo there is a picture of what, this is the border, what it looks like before you build the fence, right? And then you build a fence, and not only does it clean up the mess and keep the aliens out, it also addresses your drought problems. It's green and lush and beautiful. So you can imagine the kind of rhetoric and attitudes. It's really, I guess, from a kind of a naive Canadian point of view, some of the stuff is pretty shocking. But this is not to say that, of course, that everybody thinks this is a wonderful idea. There are, in fact, there's lots of opposition to the building of these fences. And it's not just environmentalists. In fact, the loudest voices are at the local level. Mayors, cattle ranchers, churches, the business community, local conservationists. And you're getting some interesting connections happening between, for example, the business community and local conservationists who are very much opposed to this. So, it was... And like I said, I can't underscore the importance of these issues for Americans. This conference I was at, actually, a lot of the time was spent discussing this. And, you know, you're sitting there listening to political science colleagues who are working for non-governmental organizations that deal with migrants, but they're talking about 10-year-old kids that are crossing the border, like trying to cross illegally to join parents, that, you know, they have to walk through the desert for 5 days, and they get picked up by the group, as in not border people, and they find the parents way off in California, and the parents are saying, send the kid home, because I'm supporting 20 extended families or members down in El Salvador, and if you bring the kid to me, then they, you know, anyway, it just kind of makes your own problems look pretty minor. But anyway, so back to the issue here. When I was going through this, I was wondering, where the heck are all the national environmental groups on this? Because this is huge, and we have a lot of very big environmental groups in the States, but they seem to be very, very quiet. Well, in fact, last summer, now remember that these laws were passed in 2005 and 2006. The Defenders of Wildlife and Sierra Club challenged the constitutionality of the Real ID Act to waive environmental laws. and a U.S. District Court judge issued a temporary restraining order. Now, in response to that, the Secretary of Homeland Security responded by waiving 19 laws relating to the protection of water, air, wildlife, endangered species, blah, blah, and on it goes. And in fact, about 2 weeks ago, this has now been kicked up. There's actually now a Supreme Court challenge. But again, I wondered, like, what took these guys so long and where were they? Well, it took a little digging to figure it out, but I realized, oh yeah, the reason that Sierra Club is so was so silent on this issue initially was that it relates to an issue, I don't, some of you may remember this a number of years ago, an incredibly divisive issue within the Sierra Club over population stabilization. I see Lorelei nodding her head back there. Like all social movements, the environmental movement has been criticized as being white, wealthy, well-educated. And they've done a lot of work trying to bring minorities and immigrants into the fold. Well, one of the major issues in the Sierra Club that a group of people took on was the notion of a population, and a very, very vocal group within the Sierra Club said, well, what we need is population stabilization. What that means is no immigration, because, especially from the third world, and the reasoning behind this is that you're living in the third world and you're not having that huge an impact on consuming resources because you're living in a developing country. But as soon as you emigrate, you know, you come to the North America, you adopt our excessive consumption patterns, and now all of a sudden you're really consuming. And so what they're saying is, no, we just need to stop the population growth. And I can see Evelyn is getting a migraine headache. You can. For you, Illuminate Lands, she's saying that we should perhaps seek the advice of China on this one. But anyway, you can imagine the absolute uproar and the huge fight that broke out. And the Sierra Club was absolutely brutalized by this debate. It was very, very divisive. There is a huge mobilization to marginalize the population stabilization guys who fought back, you know, courageously lost the battle. But you can imagine that anything that touches on immigration is not something that the Sierra Club wants to actually get into. And it was interesting because just even the other this morning I thought, gee, I better find out what's happening with that that act, or their court challenge or whatever. And there is nothing on the Sierra Club website. You can't find it on there. I mean, they're launching a court challenge at the Supreme Court level, but you have to go to the Defenders of Wildlife to find out about it, because Sierra Club won't talk about it. So these are sort of the dynamics around these issues. Okay, so having digressed, what's happening in Washington Glacier? Well, in fact, oh dear, sorry Kathy, I'm keeping you busy leaping up and doing something. One thing I didn't say that's being explored in the south, on the south border with the Americans, they're talking, they have a $20 million project of towers and cameras with radars, and it's all this incredible virtual surveillance. And they have talked about doing that in Waterton. And I should say, I think the price tag on all of these fences is about $6 billion. I mean, it's absolutely huge. But anyway, so they're talking about that in Waterton Glacier. But you know, when you look at what's going on the southern border, and then see the way that they're managing in Waterton Glacier, you think, well, maybe this is an example of how we can affect some sort of cooperation. Because after 9/11, the backcountry station was closed, so you could no longer. There's a very, very popular hiking route. There's like 37,000 visitors there. This is a real environmental, an economic boost to the local area. And there's about 4,000 people annually that take the boat across to the U.S. side and go up and go camping and hiking back there. So this is really a great example of U.S. Customs and Immigration, U.S. Border Patrol, the RCMP working together with locals to think, you know, to come up with a solution, because really the economic viability of the area was really threatened. So what they did was they came up with a bunch of different solutions. They made wardens into custom officials. And if you're Canadian or American, basically what happens is you get off the boat, you talk to the warden, and off you go. If you are not a Canadian, you either can't get off the boat, or you can go to another, what they call a front country customs place, get your papers in order, and then go through it like that. So, I mean, basically they have worked through this issue. What's happened, of course, is that the border now is quite visible. Before, they used to work on making it very invisible, and the presence of agents and, you know, airplanes and whatever is very, very is strong now, and they certainly don't try to hide it. So you think, I'm sorry about this, Kathy, I'm about to switch slides again. But yeah, as long as you're Canadian. As long as you're Canadian or American. I mean, really, it's kind of laughable, because, I mean, you get across, if I was a terrorist, so you get across there, terrific. Now you've got like hundreds of kilometers you've got to hide. Yeah. Oh, no, that's it. And you think about all the food you'd have to carry just to get somewhere. I mean, it's, yeah. So, so I guess, you know, on the one hand, some people are arguing, well, this is a very clear example of a success story. I mean, look at how well these guys work together, and they, you know, but it's pretty hard to say, well, okay, you know, whether or not the lessons in collaboration in this example could really be applicable to anything. I mean, we're talking about, you know, a fairly remote area, and you're also talking about neighbors that more or less share the same values. But it is going to be interesting to see what happens with this. Because, you know, and again, I guess you could argue that, you know, if we could get past the, you know, start focusing on the actual ecosystems and protecting them, then, you know, I mean, maybe we'd move ahead on some of these issues. But, and I don't want to actually lowball the importance about this, because the fact that conservationists now are actually talking about humans in the context of their environment, that they're talking about an ecosystem with human beings in it, is pretty remarkable. And it's not just in Canada. In Arizona, I was on a site, Center for Biological Diversity, and this quote really struck me. They were talking about these areas in like huge tracts of desert, right, that are shared between the U.S. and Mexico. And they're saying, we believe that a rational border policy would address the root causes of the current border situation, desperate poverty in developing countries, imbalanced international trade agreements, and America's dependence on cheap labor. I mean, this is such a huge shift for environmental groups, which previously to that had really dealt with conservation as if humans didn't even have a right to be there. And now we've got a conservation centers saying, you know, before we can even talk about conservation, we have to start looking at these larger human issues. But in with respect to this case, whether the desire to preserve habitat corridors for species preservation will trump the dual concerns over illegal immigration and the threat of terrorism really is anybody's guess. If the former wins, the prospects for using parks to achieve peace will be greatly enhanced. And Watersham Glacier Peace Park will continue to stand as the icon of cooperation despite the difficult issues that have had to be confronted in the first decade of the new millennium. But if it's the latter that holds sway, the world's first international peace park, I'd argue, is going to become a really quaint symbolism of the naive idealism of the previous century. Thanks. not bad, Auntie Kathy. I turned 10 minutes into just 32, right? In 2 weeks. Oh, well. Evelyn. Lauren, I was impressed by the slide where you had the differences in representation of the landscape, the wild natural sort of landscape, and then the managed landscape underneath. And I was just thinking of what a reversal that is from the sort of the ideal of the romanticized 19th century sort of romantic sort of view of the West, right, as the place of limitless whatever and all of that sort of thing, as opposed to a sort of more orderly 18th century sort of laundered, controlled kind of landscape, and what a reversal that is of the whole history of the notion of the West. And I was just thinking for our courses of students in communication studies, what a great semiotic analysis you could do. You can actually see whether or not there's a kind of PR campaign to have a look at both sides of both borders, the Mexican, you know, American, Canadian, American borders, with regard to this particular issue. If this is perhaps a one-off, or whether or not that's something that's happening, is the notion of everything is, you know, with the fences, with the policies and so on, everything is peaceful and under control inside the fence.
Yeah, plenty of that. I never thought about that. But no, you're absolutely correct. I mean, it is really sort of counter what people usually talk about when they think about the West. Not yeah, yeah. But it sure the. Yeah, please fence me in for sure is where it's at now. I mean, it is quite stunning. I mean, you read these sites, and it's the fear, the actual like profound fear like that. And that's certainly what came through to me when I was reading that. Really, sort of. I just found really fascinating. But yeah, no, I mean, you're absolutely right. Waterton Glacier, man, there's bears in them here, Bale Hills, you know. It's very uncontrolled, it's wild, it's, you know, yeah, I don't know. That wasn't an answer to the question. But
that fear, I mean, that's been a long time coming. That's been growing over decades. That isn't just a post 9/11 thing. I mean, gated communities have been around down there for, I don't know, you went to New Orleans and didn't you tell us about the gated communities? And that was, how many years ago was that? So this is just, you know, control with fear, of course.
A question that I have, Lauren. I mean, you know, when you read, you know, all of the legislation that suddenly doesn't count, and that, you know, and a lot of it being, you know, in a sense of victories in the past for environmental groups, social justice groups, it raises the obvious question of the extent to which is that a lot of this, you know, anti-terrorist hysteria isn't being used in this context as in any others, really sort of push back, you know, the social victories. Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that's it. That's why at one point there I said, like, this isn't about terrorism. I mean, that's the banner that's being waved, right? But it's not about terrorism. It's about the immigration thing. And you know, and it's interesting, like, I'm reading about the costs of these fences and where they're putting it in, and it's just like, it just boggles your mind. And in fact, a lot of the guys that are building these things, they'll say they're not going to work, but we're just building them, and so that we can say that we're doing something about this nasty immigration issue. But I mean, I think there's far bigger issues than, well, some environmentalist in here is going to take me to task on that, but you know what I mean, that there's all sorts of things that are being rolled back.
Because it really does seem, in generational terms, as the replacement, you know, now that the Soviet Union is gone, or the Cold War thing where, you know, you want a daycare, communism, you know, you want environmental, that's communism. We're fighting an international, you know, ideological war, et cetera, et cetera. Now, like, you know, that's not there, and so there's, everything is kind of, you know, anti-terrorism.
Yesterday, Bush announced reinforced Al-Qaeda.
Either that or Waterton, they're sneaking in over through the... And certainly liberals is a dirty word over there, you know, and anybody liberal, oh my God, if we have a liberal government, we must be the terrorists.
Yeah, we have to be careful we don't stereotype too much, though. I mean, there are liberal Americans. And Laura Mike, you know, you meet great Americans. They're hiking and you have to band together because of the bears, right? So you have to go in groups of six, and some of those people might be Americans. And they're very nice people, and they're just as concerned about all these issues as we are. So we have to be careful.
And actually, yeah, the rest of them that weren't hiking were at this conference I was at. I mean, it was really weird, actually, because I had a lot of people coming up to me, "Oh, you're from Canada. Oh, the land of sharing, caring." To which I would say, "Have you ever heard of a place called Alberta?" I think we're more American than you are. You know, I mean, it was in like the stereotype. Yeah, like we're just so shareful in Canada. But anyway, Meenal, I know you want to jump in.
Hi, I just wanted to mention something, you know, in the context of these policies that were the time when they were created and what's happening right now. I did this sort of regime analysis of environmental policies between the 60s and the 90s some years ago, and it was very striking to see the period when these negotiations take place really matters a lot, not just in terms of, you mentioned technology, but I think the economic cycle matters a lot more than anything else. And in that context, I think late 80s and 90s was the time when some of the most successful examples of international negotiations around environmental movement, you know, they were the most successful examples. But now we find a trend of sort of, you know, sliding back. And I suppose there is definitely a connection here with as much as the security concerns, but also the economic recession that we are going through. Although, of course, the American Reserve Bank doesn't want to admit it. They still keep saying, you know, they think there might be a recession, but they're not sure. So, but I think that is also an important aspect of which is affecting policymaking on environmental management all around the world. The American example perhaps is a lot more, you know, pertinent and also a lot more visible, but there are other examples that are emerging from other parts of the world as well that seem to directly linked to their economic cycles. So, for instance, I see that with higher growth rate in India and China, for instance, you do find that they are a little more accommodating in terms of at least policy measures. So the talk is right. You know, how does that translate into ground realities is obviously debatable. But at least they are doing, you know, in terms of policy measures and in terms of management measures, you find that the government is a lot more supportive of civil society action in that front. So, again, the economic cycle seems to make an impact there. So just a point that I thought was important.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you, Meenal. I've done a lot of work on BC environmental policy, and absolutely, it's really very, very tightly linked. What I found actually very interesting when I did this paper was the overriding of concern, I guess, that even Trump's the economic side, which is typically for environmental thing, I would agree, is a big driver, is fear, is security. It's like if you're an environmentalist, you're anti-American. Like you're not patriotic because you're putting an ecosystem ahead of your country's national security. And I wasn't really, I mean, I should know that, yes, Americans are concerned post-9/11 about security, but I was quite fascinated by that. And like I said, I was really fascinated by the fact that the American environmental groups are just keeping a very, very low profile on this. I mean, it's not like they're not doing stuff. They're doing all kinds of things. But on this particular one, because it can be linked to terrorism, it's like a no-go zone. Mm-hmm.
But again, this is perhaps also linked to what's happening in the other part of the world, where instead of fear of the other, they were using fear in terms of I suppose that unpatriotic element was there in those debates as well, where the interest of a small community of people who might be displaced by, say, construction of a dam was supposed to not override national interest in terms of creating more electricity, et cetera. So that debate is shifting in India and China. So that is why I feel that, you know, once again, I probably am putting on my political economist hat. So.
You know, it's thinking of the history of our national parks as well. I mean, Banff National Park being established as part of the economic, you know, sovereignty desires of the Canadian government, the CPR, and so on. You know, of turning that into a resource, you know, to connect with tourism and so on with the railroad. But the whole idea of control is that what's interesting, I see with looking at that fence, is that we've always had these invisible fences built in the parks. And in Banff, it was the way they excluded the native people from their traditional lands, but also the way they got rid of a lot of, and partly because of the railroad, you know, fires and everything else, but got rid of a lot of the native species and moved in other ones. But so the point is, in the end, you have something that looks like pristine wilderness untouched by humans, but they're invisible fences of history and, you know, spatial control all over it. And this just makes it more, and so we've accepted that because it seems natural to us, because, you know, and in a way this fence between, you know, on the border will come to seem natural too, right? And people gradually accept that because of the whole enculturation of, well, you know, fear, right? And I mean, you can look at the history of Banff or any park, you know, as kind of part of the extension of that history of fear, well, if we don't do this, we'll lose X, we'll lose control of the resource, we'll lose, you know, this or that possibility. But so it's really interesting to see the actual fence go up.
Well, no, and for sure in this area too, of course, there's a very, very long history of Aboriginal groups that lived in that area, and they're not really noted much in any of the history of Waterton Glacier, for sure. It's, well, you know, once the Europeans came over and seized control, well, then we could start preserving it, right?
Of course, it was pristine and never had people.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they would erect it,
yeah.
Like we will.
It's actually, you thinking or mentioning about the spatial control in Banff, too, it's kind of fascinates me now, driving through and seeing the bridges over the Trans-Canada Highway. Yeah, it's fenced with, like, boy, talk about control, but also the recognition that if you don't provide some corridors there, you're, you know, these small pockets of you know, the little whatever, it just doesn't work. And that's what they're saying with the grizzly bear, is that they've collared these guys and their range is like 1,000 kilometers for a male. So how, and that's the big push in the Yellowstone to Yukon. It's if we don't connect these and provide viable habitat, we can forget it. But of course, if you can do things on that scale, then you also have to recognize that, yeah, humans do exist in that landscape. And like I said, it's just, for me, it's just completely fascinating. I mean, it was only 10 years ago I was really into this stuff and talking to environmentalists and really focused on it, but I can't believe the shift in 10 years, the scale, but also just what's considered to be part of the environment now, which the issues and concerns that and certainly conservationists think about now was not the case 10 years ago. I mean, that's one of the papers that I'm going to be presenting, if I ever get around to writing it, is to do with that. Anyway, so if I'd been more organized, you would have got that paper instead of this one. But
actually, that does raise the broader question. In terms of environmentalists, both in the U.S. and Canada, almost any issue, in fact, can be socked at, you know, with a security thing. I mean, surely this is going on in more than just you know, a few border issues. Is it not? I mean,
well, no, that's a good question, and I don't really know, Alvin, because I only had 2 weeks to write this paper, and I was pretty focused on it.
Fair enough. But even when you think about it in terms of the oil trend.
Yes, yeah.
You know, I mean, an attack on the development of the oil sands in Alberta is an attack on North American energy security. It makes you know, makes any of us who think that development environmental holocaust, anti-patriotic and not cases.
Yeah, but I don't know. It's interesting. It just seems to me, just and based on not a lot, this and another project I'm working on in BC. And again, I was really stunned to realize that in some of the labor actions now, in BC, they're attacking labor policy. Like unions are, and they're developing coalitions with environmental groups, which you, like 10 years ago, you never would have seen that. So I think, I don't know, Elvin, because like I said, this is based on an N of one, this particular study that I looked at, but my sense is that there is a little bit more sophistication now in the arguments, and both, you know, labor and environmental activists are starting to think bigger picture. I don't know, Mina, what's your sense, having watched as the political economist in the group?
Oh, well, I mean, I had noticed some sort of a confluence of different arguments, but they seem to be sort of parallel arguments about, in the South, it was almost always development versus environment. That's how the debate worked. But I find that is changing in the South, and in the North, there seems to be the human element that you mentioned, that environment is not seen as something happening in a vacuum, that it is seen as part of a much bigger system which involves human beings. So I feel that this is, in some ways, it is these two very different and perhaps parallel branches coming closer together. I don't still see that they are talking the same language or have the same priorities, but there is definitely a broadening of perspectives on both sides. So it is no longer just a conceptual barrier between development and environment in the South, and in the North is this acknowledgement of the human aspect and their relationship with the environment, not just in negative terms. So That's something that's most visible to me. I don't know if I answered your question.
Are you familiar, Lorna, with the Cypress Hills Interprovincial Park and the development of that? Because that occurred more than 10 years ago, and there was tremendous involvement of Aboriginal groups as well as local ranchers and whatnot in the development of that interprovincial agreement. So even before 10 years ago, there were pockets of places that were moving forward in a pretty advanced way. And Cypress is certainly one of the ones that I know, because my brother worked on all the deals. So he was very involved in it and very proud of the way it finally evolved, so that they looked at multi-use and use by all involved, and how they could match as well as preserve as well as not just interacting but coexist with different foci.
Yeah, I don't know anything at all about the development of that, but yeah, no, I'll have to look at that. But it strikes me just that sort of where our discussion is going here. I did a paper years ago on federal government policy and environmental policy, and sustainable development was splashed all over the place. And I remember going on a bit of a rant about sustainable development and saying, like, yeah, like, so what is this? Everybody uses it, right? But of course, there's no agreed upon definition. But even though I'm just thinking I was so incredibly critical of the actual term, maybe, in fact, at some level, it seeped into everybody's consciousness, that both for conservationists and for business people or whatever, that there you can't do this in silos, that there has to be some sort of thought one to the other, or it's just not on. I mean, for a conservationist, you know, there are some political realities that you need to think about, right? So, Yeah.
I was wondering if either of our off-site people had any questions.
Come on, Jolene and Audrey, wake up. Come on.
Yeah, well, you have to turn the mic off if Audrey's going to talk.
Pain. Don't put him on the spot like that. I hate that when you're in Illuminate land, you know.
Seeing it as providing an opening.
No,
That was ridiculous.
Life at Athabasca University, hey? Sorry, Jolene. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's unfortunate, actually, Jolene, because I had something really incredibly profound to say, but you cut out, and then you missed it. And you would have been really impressed if you'd heard it, right? Oh, dear. I just wanted to reflect really briefly. I'm really interested in, you know, you were talking about imaginary boundaries, and we had this little discussion before the session started about how they just surveyed the 49th parallel and then they went to figure out where it was. But now it's, once you've created that concept and drawn it on the map and you posted your little survey post, now it's becoming a real thing with the construction of this fence, which is interesting and scary, and probably not the first time in history when you think of the Great Wall or Hadrian's Wall. There have been a few other instances where people tried to take a political perimeter and make it a real thing.
Lorna, it just strikes me that for... probably a sizable group of Canadians, the construction of this kind of visible boundary is perhaps reassuring for the very same, you know, political reasons to make it clear that there is a difference in politics and philosophy on each side of the border. I just throw that out because I think that could be the case for a number of people.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting point, Archie. Such a line in the sand to be able to say that, yeah, we're Canadians and we're on this side. But I mean, I guess I would say, maybe it's different living in Edmonton, but I mean, we certainly don't have any visual reminders of the border because we're too far away from it. And I think in Canada, a lot of the border is, it's unmarked.
Of course, there are some who would erect. There are some who would erect borders in the sense of stopping flows of natural resources, water, and that sort of thing, where they might naturally go. So that's a different type of border.
If we could keep the guns out, fence might be a good thing.
Jolene did ask a question about the impact on Aboriginal groups or Indigenous groups, she says.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting one because, like I said, Jolene, when I was going through this, I kind of did go off in a bit of a tangent with respect to that. And it's interesting, with Waterton Glacier, there's really not much. It was almost sort of like, well, we cleared them all out, and now we can put our park in here and not worry about things. And it happened a long time ago. The creation of the park was a long time ago. With respect to Y2Y, it is interesting. There's a huge push to involve Aboriginals in the conservation effort and trying to figure out where the common interests lie and then exploiting that, you know, to using it for both advantages. So it's a very, very different strategy with respect to Y2Y than I would imagine was the case when the Waterton Glacier was first created, because like I said back then, that was pretty easy, which you did. Another interesting aside is they're actually talking about expanding Waterton, hey, right up into Fernie, around that in that area, and expanding it quite. And it's kind of fascinating looking at the literature that around that, because again, there's a real push to talk about the what the environment or the economic spin-off of an expanded park would be. So interesting. We'll keep an eye on that too. Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know the details on that. I was reading a report that Fernie had actually put out on this proposal. Oh, that's interesting. So,
Yeah, this report was actually promoting it. They thought it was a great idea. And the arguments that they were putting forth were this is really good for the local economy. So, yeah. It's around Flathead Lake there in that area. Yeah.
I'd be interested to know if the Dempster's included in that Yellowstone to Yukon.
I'll find out for you. Report
that
back.
Back in 1975, I worked in the Yukon, and I did the Dempster, or tried to, but after three flat tires, couldn't go any further. And then it's a magnificent, absolutely magnificent area. And I was so moved by it that I wrote to Pierre Trudeau a letter that I found recently asking him to designate it a park. And they said that, you know, I got the letter back saying, of course, we will, you know, be considering this. This has been handed over to parks and whatever. And so here to hear that maybe something's being done, of course, nothing to do with my request, but I'm happy to hear that because it is an incredible area. And I've been all over Canada and many, many parks and hiked. And there's just nothing quite like it.
The Dempster Corridor is a really interesting area because they've regulated it very highly in order to be able to put that road in at all. There was a whole question of what was going to happen with the porcupine caribou herd and that kind of stuff. So there's no development along it between the North Fork Junction to when you get out of the mountains at Fort McPherson, except for the government created pit stop and flat tire emporium of Eagle Plain. And if it says as you go up the Dempster now, although it's much more settled than when you tried, a leaving 911 area kind of reminds you. If you do get in trouble, there is a highway maintenance camp at Ogilvie, at the Ogilvie River, and somebody might rescue you at that point, and another one at the NWT boundary at James Creek. But it is very interesting, because of course there are all these questions about the Vuntut-Gwich'in and the Peel River, you know, Tetlik-Gwich'in and their use of that area, and sort of how, what kinds of protection are needed and what kinds of co-management are going on in the area. There are some parks, I'm trying to remember, there is one in the Old Crow area, but that's a little bit off from the Dempster to help protect the porcupine caribou, which is another boundary conservation issue since that herd runs from Alaska through the Yukon and you know, just into the NWT there and is incredibly important for the First Nation that also runs through those three jurisdictions. So I'll quit babbling about the North. It's one of my favorite places too, though.
See, and I thought we were going to be able to blame the fact that it wasn't made a park on her because she forgot to mail her letter. I found it the other day.
There's never much discussion about the Alaska-Yukon border, though. That's the Canadian-American border, too, and there doesn't seem to be much going on there at all. I guess it's just not, because it's not, the Mexicans are obviously not coming in that way, but the Filipinos are, interestingly enough, but you haven't heard anything, any noise about that, and any of the environmental related issues with that border, or talks of a fence, or it's just completely quiet, right? And it's just, you go into chicken, and that's it, right?
This conference actually is happening in Finland in a couple of years. I'm thinking that would be a good border to look at. You just gave me an idea for. I don't know anything about it. It's,
yeah, when I was up there was no. You just drove the top of the world highway. Did they got it now?
Yeah. Okay. There's a little shack with a lady sitting in it.
Okay, that's.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, but you still get the feeling if she's in a bad mood, you're screwed. You know.
I always used to think of the border at Hyder, Alaska into BC. I always figured this was long before 9/11, but if you wanted to smuggle someone into Canada, you send them to Ketchikan and have them come in on the mail plane or the once a week ferry to Hyder, and they used to close the border at 5 o'clock, and, you know, but everybody was driving back and forth because Hyder, Alaska lives on BC tourists who want to drink all night and, you know, and drink Everclear and get Hyderized. So I don't know what's happened with that interesting little possible way into the country since 9/11 either.
All sorts of places for those Americans should be paying attention to, hey?
I was just reflecting on what Archie had suggested a little bit earlier, and some of the things that Karen was talking about the history of Canada and fences and borders, and the fact that our history is actually largely free of the visible sorts of, I was thinking about Northrop Frye's sort of garrison mentality, you know, how many forts do we have, and do we have that long history of medieval walled towns and so on, and we don't actually. If you think of the sort of the fortress living areas, we're fairly short-lived in the history of the country. And so, you know, what is our reaction to having walls thrown up, you know, between this country and another? We actually don't have a long history of sort of physical things standing between us and our neighbors. So, I mean, those are just sort of vague notions about, you know, what do we normally expect to be, to see, I guess, and what do we expect to be able to see through?
Well, couldn't you make that argument about Americans, though? I mean, they're...
The main history of the Americans, in fact, is going further and grabbing more areas. Particularly, you know, after all, they've got half of Mexico now is within their country. So it is a move away from their frontier notions, you know, towards a much more enclosure kind of thing. Yeah.
I always remember my dad was born in 1914 and here in Alberta, and talking about his father had a massive ranch, and I remember him talking about, he remembers when they began building fences, and I said, well, were you fencing the cattle in? He said, no, actually, we were fencing the cattle out of the crops. The cattle roamed free, but we just needed to protect the grain and so on. So there was I think there is a different sort of sense of what fences are for and what stockades are for and so on. I don't think it's identical.
Your discussion of the Alaska border made me think again. I was recently doing some historical research, and Fort Yukon, now well into Alaska, was built by the HBC, and they really didn't want to know where the internationally agreed upon boundary was. And so for a long time they pretended that the river that they were on at Fort Yukon was not in fact the one that flowed into the Bering Strait. And they were sort of chagrined when somebody, you know, connected up the dots irrevocably and somebody actually took astronomically determined position to you know, prove unequivocally that they were there, and then they had to move back to Rampart House up toward Old Crow because they realized they were actually substantially trespassing in Russian and then later American territory.
Great, give me all sorts of bright ideas. focus, right?
Kind of obvious question, though, would be whether the environmental situation in these parks really has suffered as a result of these changes. All the lofty goals that you read from the 1932 agreement, which sound wonderful, how much of that ever, you know, was in practice? And then B, you know, with the removal of the application of every act, how much, you know, has really changed?
Well, I think actually that there was a very high level of cooperation mm-hmm. between the two parks, and I think it started out just really because of the personal friendship between these two guys who, you know, it was at least a dozen years, maybe 20 years, that they collaborated, and sort of that was the big push. And then from that, it just kind of...
you know, I think there really truly was or has been a long history. And, you know, maybe that's the reason that the Yellowstone to Yukon thing is happening, because there is that long history. And, of course, that's not the same history that you've got in the south and the southern frontier of the states. But, I was reading all sorts of stuff on the various endangered species and whatever, in this desert habitat. And, of course, what's happening right now is as they build the fences, they started first by putting them in the heavily populated areas. And, of course, all it's doing, it's driving people out into the desert through these very fragile ecosystems. And, oh, my gosh, the stories of, I just had no idea the number of people that die crossing the American border. And, of course, now, like, die in the desert. They actually have groups that's what they do. They go around picking up bodies. That's their deal. And then they try, other groups to try and match the bodies with names and get them back. And just the horrific stories. And you just, like I said, it was not something that I really knew a lot about. And when I went to this conference, there was a lot of Mexicans, so that tended to be what the focus of the conference was on, was just that whole, the absolutely devastation that's happening because of these policies. Just push them out into the desert and 5 days walking through the desert to get to another populated area. And yeah, well, it creates another problem with all those dead bodies lying around, you know. It's, yeah. But, it's really...
Lorna, I was just thinking about my experience in one of the great game parks in Africa. And if you've ever been there, one of the strategies they use is to fence the people in. In other words, the land is open, but you have to be in a fenced, walled enclosure at night. Within the confines of those parks. Otherwise you get eaten. I'm just wondering if that sort of approach might not work for this kind of situation, where it's not so much setting a boundary, but setting zones of occupation in which you must register and whatever, which are controlled. I don't know, it just struck me that it might be...
So you're suggesting that they put a fence up sort of around where the...
Around the camps. Around the camps, and you're supposed to be in one of those camps.
Well, yeah, but the issue isn't animals, right?
No, but I mean, it might have this... But the point is, then you wouldn't have to put a fence along any boundary.
But the advocates of the fence don't care about the habitat and the conservation and the safety of people. They want to keep the illegal migrants out.
Yeah. But all I'm saying is it would also be a way of controlling who came and went if those controlled zones, you know, were policed, were, you know, whatever.
Then you'd have different borders, wouldn't you? Because, I mean, here what you're largely looking at is a supposed international border. The concern is not really with wildlife as such. The concern is simply with keeping people from going from point A to point B, because you think you're going to get illegal immigrants that way. You're going to get dope. You'd be talking about something, I think, rather different if you're talking about looking at areas for wildlife. Those wouldn't necessarily be current international borders. They'd be borders more within...
Well, I guess my idea, I don't know the park that well, so my idea would be dependent upon whether you could actually survive outside any formalized camping or camp facilities, and you know, for days. I don't know.
Oh yeah, no, people do it all the time. Actually,
but maybe if it was a requirement that you had to go to these designated zones.
Yeah, but if you're a terrorist, you wouldn't go to a designated zone. Wouldn't you be hiding in a tree?
Yeah. But you might find it hard to get through the terrain and you know, with... Just a thought.
Jolene has a comment. And she said, and now they have a 15-foot fence in the desert, but pregnant women have been spotted successfully scaling the wall. So that's...
YouTube, man. You wouldn't believe the stuff you can find on YouTube for exactly that. People, like, and it's amazing, these guys, like, you look at this big, tall wall, and, man, they're up, they're over it, under it, they're, you know... I don't know. Yeah. Yeah.
I think one of the things that we that just struck me, I've been thinking about this a lot. I know the area, the Waterton Park and so on. It seems to me that there's more than just one fundamental difference between that border and what's going on with Mexico. My family also lives down there. In Waterton, on both sides of the border, what you get is middle class people going backpacking.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, there is no threat of terrorism. Yeah. There's no threat of illegal immigration. You know, and I mean, there's just this assumption that. This is a pristine area, as we've talked about before, you know, and there's no real thought given, I don't think, to the political situation. It's people there on holidays having a great time, whereas if you look at the Mexican-U.S. Mm-hmm. border, you know, the situation is entirely different. You know,
yeah.
You've got the total economic imbalance, and people all the way up into Colorado and Wyoming and so on are afraid of the illegal immigrants and are passing laws to control it at the state level, not even the federal level anymore. So it seems to me that it would be great if we could consider the two situations as equal. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely, and that's what struck me when I was reading all the stuff on peace parks. And I'm thinking, you know, it's one thing to hold Waterton Glacier as the big example of why this concept is going to work internationally, but like we speak the same language. We don't normally shoot at each other. We don't have any really complex issues. It's a conservation thing, and we share that. And you know, let's just take the other border, and all those issues that you're talking about are absolutely true. And I don't know, it seems a little naive to me, but then.
Yeah. Well, the argument, one American argument, is that the terrorists are using the Canada and our soft laws and our nice personalities and stuff to dupe us and go across the border. So that's the argument for keeping it fast all across, that there is the slippage where it is not paying attention. So that's where they're imposing this sort of rigorous regime on the whole country, basically.
Lorna, I wonder, I might have missed it earlier. I know there are peace parks all across the country, and many of them in areas where it's much, there's a lot more transborder traffic than here. You know, in BC and Manitoba and so on, these things exist everywhere. And I might have missed it in your presentation because I was too busy looking at the gorgeous pictures. Is the notion that this wall will simply go right from one end of the country to the other? Are the other peace parks also part of this program?
Well, I think that, okay, the only two that I know of, because they were on the panel that I did this on, was the point, or what do you call it, the one between Lane and in BC, and then but they're not peace parks. They're friendship. They're slightly different, anyway. And I think the concern here, like with those, if you think about Archie's idea, there's a fence around them, and like I'm thinking of the Manitoba one. I've never been there, but the way this fellow was describing it, that it seems to me that it's much more controlled because it's a smaller area. So when you go in it, you're in sort of this controlled space. But the trouble with Waterton Glacier, it's huge. It's really huge. Most of it's on the American side, but as Ian was suggesting, you know, those sloppy Canadians are the ones that's where you get the access to this, right? So, yeah, there's no mountains. Yeah, it's flat, it's easy to see, it's contained, and it's not that big.
It's actually a peace garden, called a peace garden. Yeah.
I think we have another Jolene comment there. Maybe you could read it out, Lorna?
Yes. It seems that fencing between U.S. and Canada is rather selective. In other words, there are large zones that are not the focus of this fencing hysteria. So it is hard not to view the fence as an ideological message rather than a real need to keep people in and out. See? Keep typing, Jolene. No pressure. How fast do you type? No, I mean, there's no doubt that this is selective, and like I said, with oh dear. And it's interesting too with in the States, like reading about the construction of these barriers. I'd argue it's a message too, because like I said, I was reading stuff. But, I mean, I don't think people in government even believe that they're really going to work. They're just, it's really, a lot of it's just political. We're doing something. Look at us. We're addressing this problem. We're getting hard on terrorism. But, I mean, the only thing that happens, you put the fence up, it just means people go around it. They go further out, like I said, into the desert. So, with amazing human cost. But I did run into a few things, looking at that, the whole issue in the cell, where they're talking about what you're talking about, and like, well, you know, we're so worried about there, but really we need to start focusing on the northern border, and there seems to be less concern, but certainly you'd think, well, this is an example of how it should be, as opposed to, I think it's being turned around and saying, yeah, well, we've got two borders here, and we should be concerned about the other one too. So,
whenever I visit my sister in LA, I'm astonished with how bilingual a place it now is, and they can't even estimate the number of people in LA County, because there are so many people who basically never answer questions from anybody who's, you know, census people and so on. But the whole society there is really built around that sort of cheap, scared, illegal labor. I mean, even 10 or 15 years ago, I found it astonishing to hear how much Spanish was spoken on construction sites if you're just walking by. You know, it's kind of a weird double think. We don't want them to have rights, but we want them in here to be able to take care of our dirty work.
Actually, there's a very interesting parallel between the U.S.-Mexican border and what has happened in South Africa. The Kruger National Park borders South Africa and Zimbabwe and some other sort of countries north of South Africa. Now, South Africa is comparable to U.S. within the region. It's almost 300-400 times bigger than its next best economy in Africa, so in Southern Africa particularly. So they actually believe that they tried to fence the Kruger National Park quite belatedly, because they thought that they would be able to, you know, because there were all these, the big five already existed in the jungles, that will prevent penetration of people from these impoverished nations into South Africa's thriving economy. But that didn't prevent people from crossing very dangerous territory. Obviously, it's because of the desperation of the people. But then also there was a political angle to it, because Zimbabwe, Zambia, etc. were supporting the democratic movement of South African, African National Congress. So there was that angle as well. So it was not just economic desperation. It was also a political will of the people on the other side of the border to support their, freedom fighters within South Africa. But they did manage to fence in people, as Archie was saying, not necessarily for conservation of the environment, but basically to prevent people from, to prevent their mobility in any way possible. So this was done very effectively in South Africa in particular. They created these homelands where people were literally fenced off, and these homelands were quite illogical in some ways. Geographically, they made no sense, because you could be driving through a territory and you'll see these lush green forests and farming areas that were South Africa, and then across the street there was this arid patch which was a homeland. And then again you went into South Africa a few kilometers later. So it was quite strange, but they did manage to send some people. But what that led to in less than 5 decades was a huge population explosion, as well as a lot of socioeconomic disparities and, of course, the political instability that followed. So fencing off people has its implications. It depends on how you do it and what is the motivation behind that. But I just thought that the American-Mexican example is so similar to the Kruger Park and its usage to prevent people's mobility across the border by South Africa.
Actually, this reminds me of, and you would laugh too about this, we, about 20 years ago, I was camping with a baby in BC, and we met this Australian couple, young couple, who traveled all over the world, and over the at the campfire, they're telling us all these stories about going to these wild game parks in Africa, and you know, knowing that there was lions and things outside their tent, and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so of course, this was right outside Revelstoke, like we were very close to the town. Anyway, of course, in the middle of the night, a bear comes along. So, of course, I'm there, I've got this little baby, and I'm just like, okay, like, just don't start crying, because I'm pretty sure that sounds too big to be a squirrel. So, anyway, so this thing, of course, it just snuffled around, and it, you know, went around the tent a few times, and whatever, and then eventually disappears, and then we hear this sort of plaintive, Lorna, Jim, was that what we thought it was? Yeah, that was a bear, but, you know, because we told them, like, keep your campsite clean when you go to bed, you know, make sure we clean all this stuff up. Well, anyway, the bottom line is he's too terrified. Australians spent the night in our car because they just, I thought, what is it about bears that terrify people, you know? We crawled back and, yeah, I guess.
Lorna, how are Indigenous Aboriginal peoples dealing with these border issues? Have you looked into that at all? Because, I mean, as I understand it, they certainly want to assert their rights to pass back and forth. And, you know, we have the example of the herds, the caribou herds that pass back and forth. It's just too bad that those symbolic examples couldn't infect the thinking of other people.
The big issue in Canada, I think, in terms of that cross-border would be in Ontario. What's the name of the reserve where all the cigarette smuggling happens? Gananoque. Because I lived in Ontario, actually, when all hell was basically breaking loose over that. And, I'm not, you certainly don't get the profile for the Aboriginal groups here that the ones that straddle the borders. I don't know, somebody else?
Sorry, yeah, I was just saying, what about the Blackfoot on our side of the border, the Blackfeet on the other side, who are really the same people? And as Virginia was just saying, go back and forth across the border. Aren't they affected by all this stuff? Well, they may try to ignore it, but...
Well, there isn't a wall yet.
Mm-hmm. But if there is a wall, they're going to be in... trouble.
There are treaty obligations, though, about that. Mm-hmm. First Nations and Native Americans have special rights. It would require some interesting human rights issues to abrogate those. Because at the moment, you know, yeah, they have free passage across, especially divided nations like the Kootenai and the Blackfoot and so on. Tsimshian up in, Gwich'in up in the north. Yeah.
But Leslie, if they've got legislation like, you know, they passed in terms of this stuff where, you know, they just list 85 acts that are no longer applicable, I suspect that an international treaty of that sort won't seem to them sacrosanct, you know.
Well, you might well be right on that one, but it would be an interesting international incident.
Yeah, it was interesting because that... Is it the Salish that are on the west coast, Washington State and BC? And there was one of the things I really admired about these guys that ran this conference, they had the Aboriginals that, you know, came and did their song and dance to open this conference. But I was really impressed because then they gave one of the, well, I would call him an elder, but he wasn't actually that old. And this guy got up And he gave, you know, I mean, there's a ton of Europeans in the audience, and he said, I'm going to give, you know, a little history or whatever, you know, was introduced as giving a little history of the Salish people and how that's impacted by the border. And this guy went on about a 20 to 30 minute rant. I mean, an incredibly knowledgeable and historically, from what I can tell, I mean, I'm not any expert on indigenous issues or whatever, but it seemed to me that the things that he was talking about was dead on. I mean, he was just amazing. I thought, boy, now there's an interesting concept. Rather than just having a nod to the cultural thing, let's actually talk about some of this. And those were some of the issues that he was talking about that the Salish were confronting, that they were trying to, there's all sorts of various things that they were trying to do, and yeah, the stuff was getting in the way, but from his perspective, it was the same old, same old. It was just a new act that was getting in the way of treaty, or, you know, dividing their people, I guess, so.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. A few years back, I was in Nea Bay on the Olympic Peninsula, and the people there were discussing the macaw, were, you know, of whale hunting fame, were discussing the whole business of Olympic National Park and their treaty process, and they didn't actually care how much of the land went because they were sea hunters. But in Western and international law, you can't have sea claims and you can't have sea territories. And so they discovered to their dismay that basically their traditional use areas, which were marine, suddenly became effectively a common open access areas, and they were cut off from visiting their relatives on the Canadian side, who are on Vancouver Island, if they're not related to, you know, the rest of the folks in Western Washington. I thought that was sort of an interesting perspective on boundaries. I think probably at this point I should officially thank you, but that doesn't mean everyone has to vacate the room, but we should probably turn the Illuminate recording off at this juncture. So thanks everyone for coming on and for great questions and good discussions.
Lorna, just wondering if it would be an interesting thing to find out if anyone has done any research on the effects of great walls of the past. I was thinking of Hadrian's Wall, of course, Chinese Wall. Whether anybody's ever thought to consider the impact of those on the natural environment.
Well, and the more modern one, it just occurs to me that you would know quite a bit about, Archie, because you lived in Western Australia, the Great Rabbit Proof Fence, from the north to the south. Now, that was created, I don't know how